Commentary Track. Conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello, welcome to episode 28 of the Commentary Track. I'm your host, Frank Thompson. As you might know, I was the inspiration for the unproduced Alfred Hitchcock film, The Man Who Knew Just Enough to Get By. Today we have a great one. I have my friend Steve Bingen. Steve is a terrific archivist and is the co-author of a really remarkable book called MGM Hollywood's Greatest Backlot. It's a history of course, the MGM studio, and he has a lot of insight into this stuff in addition to all the knowledge he has. And Debbie Reynolds wrote the foreword. Debbie Reynolds never wrote a foreword for one of my books, and that's just one more reason why I'm bitterly jealous of Steve Bingen. Yet, I managed to keep a good face on it for the course of this terrific interview, and I hope you'll enjoy it. Let me get a little business out of the way before we go to it, though. I'm glad to say that for the very first time since this podcast began 6 months ago, for the very first time, I actually got money back from the Amazon links. They do a small charge to put the Amazon link on your website, and the amount of use that I've gotten from other people who have ordered things through my website has never quite gotten me back enough money to pay for the link. But this month, for the very first time, I got more than I paid for the link. So this is definitely a step in the right direction. The trend is upward. From here on, the sky's the limit. And I know that in my heart of heart, just knowing how the world works, that every week is going to get bigger and bigger and double and then triple in size until soon every single week because of you buying things on Amazon. And you're going to buy things on Amazon because Amazon has everything that you could want to buy. So you buy things on Amazon through my website, thecommentarytrack.com. I get a little bit of a kickback, and you're soon going to be doing in such numbers, such vast numbers, that I'll be sleeping every night on a huge mountain of money like Scrooge McDuck. I might even have a swimming pool filled with coins like Scrooge. I might even start wearing a top hat like Scrooge McDuck. I'll keep wearing pants, though. I owe that to you, the listener. Also, I had a couple of people in the last couple of weeks make contributions to the podcast, and that's easy to do too. On the website, there's a donate button, and it'll take you to PayPal, and you can very easily give me even a small amount of money to help keep this thing going, because I would certainly like this to someday become a break-even project. I mean, that really is a pathetic dream to have, isn't it? That I just want to break even. But I'll take my dreams one step at a time. Thank you. One thing you can order through Amazon is the new Blu-ray of White Zombie, for which I provided a commentary track. I'm glad to say that I've looked it up online. I Google this Blu-ray every now and again. And by and large, my commentary has been getting a positive response. Many people have liked it. The worst review I think I got was a guy called it dry but insightful. Well, I didn't think it was that dry. Nevertheless, I take the hits with the prizes, so I will accept that. But still, dry? Come on, I'm a lively. Never mind. But I hope that you will watch it. The movie is terrific. If you don't know it, it's a 1932 film with Bela Lugosi, Madge Bellamy, the great Clarence Muse in a very brief role, but I think he might be the first person in the history of cinema to say the word zombies, because it's the first zombie movie. And it's really atmospheric, beautifully shot, and this restored print, I think, looks terrific. I was happy to be involved with the project, and I hope that you will see your way clear to ordering it. Now, again, I don't make anything from this. I'm not going to make any money by advertising this. They're not even paying me to advertise it. I'm just saying because I'm on it, and because you're listening to this, you might be interested in listening to that. And if you do order it through my website, at least I'll get 6 cents back or something, or maybe a quarter. I don't know what I'm going to get back, but not much. But if I, you know, just 40 million of you, let's say a minimum 40 million people order it, then that could turn into real money for me. So I'd appreciate that. So that's enough plugging for the time being, and we will get right to the interview with Steve Bingen. And I think this is a great one. I really had a good time talking with Steve. Enjoy it, and I will see you on the other side. First off, I never really talked to you much about just how you got interested in movies. Were you always a movie buff?
I guess that's kind of bred into your genes, isn't it? Because my parents weren't movie people at all. No one else in my family was. But I always found movies so much more fascinating than real life. And I grew up a long ways from the lights of Hollywood. So I always thought when I was a kid and I was watching these movies that it'd be so fascinating to be able to hop a boxcar and go to Hollywood, and when you get there, to climb the fences at these big, vast movie studios that you occasionally see referenced in other movies. Sometimes if you'd watch films about Hollywood, there'd be sequences where Jerry Lewis or something would climb the fence at Paramount, and great hilarity would ensue as he has adventures wandering around the studios. And I thought this would be so much fun, and I kept thinking this would probably be more fun than actually watching the movies would be. And I, for some reason, there was always a schism that way for me that most other people didn't have. I kept thinking that the studios, the factory, in some ways, had to be even more interesting than the product that that factory was making. And I always thought that was where the real guts of what Hollywood was all about was the studios itself. And it always frustrated me because most books about movie studios, or allegedly about movie studios, were really just about the movies themselves. Like, if I'd go to the library and I'd pick up a book called The Films of MGM or The Films of Paramount, and I'd lug the thing home, and then I'd be really disappointed to find out that it literally was about the films. It wasn't about the studio. There might be one aerial shot where they'd show the studio, and there'd be a paragraph of text somewhere inside this book, and it'd say, the studio was amazing. It was marvelous. It was like a combination Lunatic Asylum and Oz. And people who walked through the place would never forget it. But then that's all it would say. And then they would go back to discussing Joan Crawford or Spencer Tracy or something like that. And as interesting as they were, I kind of wanted to know what the environment and what the atmosphere and the place that bred people like Joan Crawford and Spencer Tracy really was, and what it was like to drive through the fence being Spencer Tracy or Joan Crawford, mm-hmm. and what they did over the course of their day in that studio, in that Oz-like dreamland. So that's kind of my weird bias, and I don't know how many other people, and I used to really wonder how many other people thought that this sort of thing was even interesting, because I talked to a lot of movie buffs who would never even give a second thought about where the movie was actually made. And I always thought that was really surprising, since, as you might have noticed, especially in the old days, studios really did have a house style.
Sure.
You know, you could kind of tell a Paramount picture from an RKO picture. And a lot of that came from the place where they were physically made, where they were crafted, and the fact that the same hands each time were crafting all the movies that came off that assembly line.
Now, where did you grow up?
I was afraid you'd ask me something like
uh-oh.
That.
Uh-oh. You forgotten?
I was born in Seattle, actually. But I guess my movie fanaticism kind of caught hold when I was in a serious way, probably in junior high or high school, which was in the wilderness of Idaho. And I usually don't tell people that I grew up in Idaho because it opens me up to lots of variations on the same five jokes involving potatoes.
Or white supremacists.
Well, there's a few of those there, too. And so I was really a fish out of water there. I mean, I went to college in Idaho as well. And, like, I went to a school that was the main bias was agricultural. So in order to call myself a film major, I had to take the same three film classes like four times in order to get the credit and get access to the equipment. So,
hey, you forget that I lived in Idaho for a year, too, you know.
Yes, that's what
I loved it. I thought it was the greatest place I ever lived. It was wonderful.
You know,
not for movies, not for seeing movies, but for seeing beautiful vistas. That was it was gorgeous.
It was gorgeous. It also has really cold winters there.
Yeah.
So
California is better for that.
Yeah. And, you know, I always thought, you know, at some point I'm going to, like, shake the potato dust off myself and go down to Hollywood, and I'll take over the industry somehow. And everybody in the history of the industry who said they're going to shake the potato dust off, figuratively or literally, and go to Hollywood and take over the industry, no one has ever actually did it. I think the people that actually take over the industry are the ones that are going to business school or law school or something like that. So when I got out of college, though, I thought, you know, what I should do is I should go to another market, a smaller market where they make movies allegedly, and if I get a good resume and some experience and some a little bit of industry savvy there, it'll be that much easier when I actually come out to L.A. And, of course, it doesn't work that way. I went to Atlanta, and I worked there for a few years in the biz, so such as it was there, and Florida. And I worked on some big pictures, and I got some experience in production. But when I came out to L.A., I mean, I was just 4 years older than all the kids who had just gotten out of school, and they were standing outside the same fences of the same studios as I was, and I was just a few years older than them. And my resume didn't impress anybody because it was all about who are you playing tennis with out here. So, you know, I wasn't quite as savvy as Jerry Lewis in being able to actually climb over those fences and have those amazing adventures that I've been dreaming about all those years. So.
See, you should have stuck with your first plan. Just hopped over that fence.
Oh, don't think I didn't try that a few times. I did my share of studio hopping because I still found these places so endlessly fascinating, and I didn't understand people who, I had friends who would say, you know, it's just a big industry. It's just a bunch of buildings. And I thought, yes, but they're the most romantic buildings in the world because all my dreams and all the dreams of a whole culture came out of those buildings and those vast sound stages and those back lots.
Well, I remember when I was a little kid, half the shows on TV were Westerns, and all of those Westerns were made by Warner Brothers, and every one of those shows would start off with this aerial shot of the Warner Brothers studios. And so I can remember being 5 and 6 years old and having a sense that there was a Warner Brothers studios and that really cool stuff happened there. And I swear to you, I have never been on that lot, and I've been on that lot a million times. I've never been there that I haven't thought, when I was 6 years old, I was looking at aerial shots of this place, and now I'm walking around.
If they were still doing that, you could zoom in and actually see yourself.
Yeah, that would be so cool.
I remember that thing, actually. It was amazing. It'd say, from Hollywood, and it'd show that vast studio with all those huge barn-like structures and these wrens of little standing sets out in the background. When I was an archivist at Warner Brothers, we actually bought some of that title art, the glass title art that they would actually photograph. And you could actually look at this thing, and I'd think, how many times have I seen this thing? And how many times have how many people seen this same picture?
Yeah.
And how many of us were actually influenced in some way by seeing that? And I just thought, how cool is that?
It is cool. But that being said, to me, I never gave that much more thought about the studios themselves. I was always a location guy. It was always, I always loved seeing, and I think that probably started because when I was 11 years old, my parents took me to Alamo Village in Brackettville, Texas, where John Wayne had built his sets for the Alamo. And so it was the first time I'd ever just walked around a set from a movie that I had seen, and it was profound for me. I mean, at 11 years old, it was really an incredible moment. And it probably would have been the same thing if I'd gone to a studio and just walked around the back lot and said, oh, look, there's the house from Singing in the Rain, or, you know, something like that, maybe. But it was always the location stuff for me.
I had that Alamo Village moment, too, because I did the same thing probably when I was about the same age. And I was profoundly affected by it, too, because I love the movie. So that is terrific, and it's wonderful, but I always felt like any place out on a location is almost a third-generation copy of what's going on inside the gates of the actual studio itself, because I think it's interesting how now people are writing books about movie locations, which are terrific. I've got a friend, John Bankston, who has written, as you know, books about where he pinpoints exact locations where Buster Keaton or Charlie Chaplin shot their movies, and he has this unerring eye where he can strip away 70, 80 years of architecture and figure out where a scene took place. But I look at it and I think, in all honesty, yes, that's one little sequence. That's 40 seconds of a wonderful Buster Keaton picture he shot in front of this building. But when you go to a movie studio, if you take any equivalent wall or building or facade or even the administration complex and the actual buildings where real people, such as they are in Hollywood, actually work, you're talking dozens or hundreds of movies that shot sequences in those same places. The amount of ghosts colliding with each other in a place inside a movie studio is so profound and so great compared to anywhere else in the world. Even the streets in L.A., which have all been filmed many, many times.
Sure.
Very often you'll see a movie where someone will be proud of it. Someone will write a book about locations, and they'll show you a sequence in a film where a sequence was shot from a particular film. And that's terrific, but very often, if you watch the movie carefully, the establishing shot will be shot on that real street in that real place. But the closer stuff, they've went back to the studio and replicated it inside a soundstage. So most of that movie and most of that scene that people love so much was probably actually shot inside a studio or inside the studio backlot.
Absolutely.
So it always struck me that where the real stuff happened was the fact that you could take the same wall or the same facade or the same saloon doors and use them again and again and again. And the amount of footage involving these separate places was so vast. Like, I always think it's cute, like if you go to places where they shot one movie or two movies, it almost becomes like a cultural shrine for these communities. Go to Marfa, Texas, where they shot Giant.
Mm-hmm.
And they're still talking about that, even though if you
sure.
watch the movie, probably most of that film was probably shot on the Warner Brothers lot, actually.
Yeah.
I've been corresponding with a terrific lady in Idaho, of all places, who called the Warner Brothers archives. And I just happened to pick up the phone, and she was talking about how a Clint Eastwood movie, Bronco Billy, had been shot in Nampa, Idaho, 30 years before or something like that, and she was wondering if I could help her out on it. And I had actually been living in Nampa, Idaho at the time this was being made, and out of the 5,000 people at Warner Brothers, I was the one that happened to pick up the phone, and I just had to confess to her that I was not only would I know about this, but I was actually there when it was happening, and I stood around on the location and watched Clint work.
I was living in Eagle when scenes were shot there.
See, what are the odds, huh?
Yeah.
See, if we saw this contrivance in a movie, we'd say this was faulty script writing, wouldn't we?
Yeah.
So I had to help her out, but, I mean, her entire career as a writer has been based on tracking down locations where Clint Eastwood shot this movie. This was 30 years ago, but Clint has made dozens of movies since then, and most of them had sequences, including Bronco Billy, that were shot on the studio lot.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like the real guts of where stuff happens is inside these fences, inside these sound stages. I've got a friend who works in the tour department at Warner Brothers, and he told me once that he had a lady and her daughter who came and took the tour, and they took him aside, and they both said to the lady and her daughter, who was a teenager, both said, you know, the thing that we bonded over as a mother and daughter is the movie Casablanca, and we'd love to see the soundstage that Rick's Cafe was in. So he drove him out there, and he said, honestly, he wasn't sure which stage it was. He'd heard that it was stage 8, but the stages have been renumbered several times since 1943, so he wasn't sure if it was the current stage 8 or not. But he took her out there, and he said, I think this is it. And they said, can we get out of the cart? And he said, sure. So they got out of the cart, and they walked over, and they laid their hands on the walls of the stage like it was a holy relic, like they were touching the Wailing Wall or something like that. And then they came back with tears running down their face, and they said, we don't have to see anything else. We've been to where Rick's Cafe was.
Wow.
Later on, he found out that Stage 8, luckily, was the only soundstage on the lot that hadn't been renumbered. So it was actually the real soundstage. So their meeting God moment was actually, they actually met God at the actual right soundstage instead of a wrong
one. That's really. And there are other places still on the lot where Casablanca was shot, though.
You know, there's a little boulevard.
Is that window?
There's a little boulevard called French Street. And I did a lot of work trying to figure out if it actually was the same French Street that the Paris flashback sequences mm-hmm. were shot in. And if you watch the film really carefully, it really does look like the same street. But I'm a little concerned about if it actually is the same location or not, because I went and looked up the slated set shots from that film, and on the slates for the location shots, it says French Street. But the scary part is that the actual French Street in 1943 was a different spot in the studio, which was torn down later that year, and the street that was that's still on the Warner Brothers lot that's now called French Street, at the time was called Viennese Street. So I'm not really sure if it's the same French Street or not, although I don't know what time of year the original French Street was torn down and they started using Viennese Street as French Street. And maybe when they wrote the slate, because it was playing France, they wrote French Street as opposed to the French Street on the back lot. So it's debatable whether or not that's the same street that's in the movie, but I'm not going to torpedo that holy grail.
Yeah.
If people want to believe that that's the French Street, maybe it is.
I only want to believe the truth. I have noticed, like, the Warner Brothers tour is better than any other tour in terms of real nuts and bolts. Here's how a movie is made and here are the places. But I have caught those people in some pretty big fibs. And I think they're just mistakes. I don't know if they're fibs. But I was working on a book on the making of a movie called Demolition Man with Sylvester Stallone and Wesley Snipes.
It's one of the Immortals, yeah.
One of the Immortals. And Sandra Bullock, one of her first, that's the movie in which she bit me, and I will tell that story some other
Please
time.
Please do.
But
you can tell it now if you like.
It takes a good deal of build-up. But a lot of that was shot on stage 16 of Warner Brothers, which, as you know, is the tallest stage, at least in the country, and maybe the world. It's huge. And it was the top of it was raised at the and William Randolph Hearst paid the bill because it was raised for a movie called
Cain and Mabel.
Cain and Mabel, because that's part of the punchline of this story, because of Marion Davies and Clark Gable, and Marion Davies being Hearst's mistress. Warner Brothers did not want to raise the roof so that they could do this high shot that they wanted, so Hearst footed the bill. So I was standing outside stage 16 one day, and along comes a tour group. And the tour guide said, "And here is stage 16, the tallest stage in the world. It was raised X number of feet above all the rest for the movie Citizen Kane." And then they moved on, and all the people were snapping pictures. Ooh, Citizen Kane. I've heard of that. So,
well, one Kane's about the same as the other, right?
So I still have always felt that I was admirable for not rushing after them saying, "No, he's wrong."
Yes,
stop.
I've had to bite my lip several times for similar reasons. You say, like, "Wow, that's a whopper." But a lot of the people that work there, they're personable because they're wannabe actors in some cases. So they're good at telling stories. And,
yeah,
you know, it doesn't really matter if the story has any basis in truth or not. But once again, a place like Warner Brothers is so astonishing and circus-like anyway that there's enough interesting stuff there that actually does bear at least a passing handshake to the truth.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's you really don't have to make up too many stories, I think, to make the place sound really fascinating. That said, I've taken people through who don't see any romance about the place either. They're just like, this is just a bunch of old buildings. And
yeah,
I'm kind of like, you're really in the wrong place. Yes, it is a bunch of old buildings. That's what makes it so fascinating.
Yeah, I've been with people like that too, who don't really see what there is. They'd rather just see the movie. They don't, seeing this part of it doesn't interest them, and that always makes me like them less.
Well, people always would say to me, you know, "Well, what movie stars are we going to see?" And I'd say, like, "Well, I wish I could take all the actors that are working here today and chain them together and crack a whip and parade them in front of you, but I don't know if that's going to happen. So what you should go to see is the biggest star in Hollywood, which is Warner Brothers Studios." And that would always feel like a cop-out answer to them, because that's, at the end of the day, you know, they really want to just see Sandra Bullock trying to bite
sure.
someone.
Yeah. So, well, who doesn't want to see that?
Who doesn't want to see that?
Now, what was the first studio that you ever saw from the inside?
Actually, oddly enough, it was Warner Brothers, because when I got to California, I had my brother had dated someone at some point whose aunt worked at Warner Records. And she had came out to California and had no affinity for the business, for the entertainment industry at all. She hated it. She wanted to move back to Idaho. But she was still, apparently my brother had broke up with her amiably because when I called her up, she agreed to phone me a pass to go into the studio with my brother one day and wander around. And I don't even know if my brother remembers the day. Like I said, there's no other people that have the film bug, particularly in my family. So I don't know where I got it, but I will never forget that day, because even though I didn't know where I was going and I was afraid we were going to be picked up by security at any moment, it was astonishing walking around. And even if you didn't recognize something, you tended to attach titles of films to every facade that you'd see, and you'd start saying, well, this is probably used in this film, or this might have been used in this film. It turned out I was wrong in almost every case when I started actually studying this sort of thing, but it just struck me even at the time as being just about as romantic as I always assumed it would be. And I was kind of spoiled, because Warner Brothers, honestly, is one of the few studios that still feels a lot like a movie studio.
Yeah.
One of the things I got to do, it must have been shortly after Warner Brothers, I actually talked to the head of the grip department at Fox, and I've been working as a grip electrician in Florida and Georgia. So, and for some reason, he decided to talk to me, and he invited me over to the lot, and he sat me down, and he said, you know, kid, you can probably get into the union as a grip if you just hang outside our studio gates every morning. He said, come in at 6 o'clock, and when the call goes out for all the grips that they need that day, if the union can't supply the people that you need, they'll swing open a back gate in the studio and you can come in. And if you do that X amount of times, you'll get your union card. And I was like, well, okay, I guess if that's what I have to do, that's what I'll do. And he said, I do have to warn you, though, kid, is that I've been here for 32 years, and that's only happened 8 times. So I decided my career as a grip was probably going to come to a close at that point. But after I talked to him, I walked around the studio a little while ago, and I remember being, I won't say disappointed, because it's a beautiful place, but it doesn't feel as much like a Hollywood studio is supposed to feel like in all the cliches and in all the movies that I'd seen, like Warner Brothers still does. Warner Brothers still has a big back lot and dozens of sound stages. And if you go to the commissary, if you're lucky, you'll see a guy dressed like an Indian eating at the commissary with a guy dressed like a cowboy. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these stereotypes come to life more at Warner Brothers than in other studios. So
yeah.
The guy at Fox, I remember he said that he was always so mad at the people that ran the studio because they wouldn't let him keep lights and scaffolding out on the studio streets anymore. And they kept saying to him, you know, we want this place to look like a campus. And he said, I kept telling them, what's wrong with it looking like a movie studio? But see, there was this mindset, and there still is to a certain degree, that a movie studio should be a nice, pretty place for people who never get their hands dirty to go to their offices and call people on their telephones and say, look, I'm working in a movie studio. At Warner's all the time, people in offices would get upset because their cars would get diverted, their parking spot would be taken away, or their office hallway would be used as a location.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd be so upset that the studio was actually being used for production, and I never really understood that.
I don't get that either. When I worked at Disney for a year, a little less than a year, and my office, I was working with Scott McQueen, who's now at UCLA, a genius of film restoration. And our office was in the animation building, the old animation building, where you can paint. Anyway, we looked out the window, and there was this town set. And it wasn't an old set. I think it had been built for Something Wicked This Way Comes. So it was only, you know, it wasn't old, but it was a whole town set right outside the windows, and during the course of the time that I was there, it was demolished piece by piece, and then another huge building just put there.
An office building
or
something.
An office building. So now when you go there, there's nothing there. And I also remember the other indignity. My first trip out here was in 79, and we went to several of the studios when we were here, including Disney. And I remember the whole residential street where the, you know, the Pollyanna house and the Shaggy Dog house and all that stuff was. And then we saw some haciendas and those kind of sets from Zorro. And it was way down at the very back end of the lot. And I came back a few years later, and all those sets were gone, replaced with these, like, movable buildings, or these, you know, like prefab buildings. And there was a sign there that called it Zorro Street.
That's
and
there.
I thought, it's like cutting down all the elms and calling it Elm Street, you know. It's just
tearing down paradise and building a parking lot. Yeah, that's their way of paying tribute. They're like, it's okay if it'll be our tribute to Zorro by naming the street after it.
So there's almost no backlot left at Disney. There's still some major streets, the Hello Dolly stuff at Fox.
Mm-hmm.
But even what's gone at Warner Brothers since the first time I saw it, all those Western sets.
Yeah, that was beautiful.
All that stuff was great. And I remember we saw, it was when Fantasy Island was being shot, and that lagoon back in the back. And then the Waltons' house was just yards away from that. And then right around, you keep walking through this kind of wooded area, and they were shooting a scene from Dukes of Hazzard. And so that, in a way, to me, that day at Warner Brothers, that first trip in 79, was the greatest seeing a movie studio in action kind of day, because they were filming in all these places. You know, Fantasy Island being shot here, then we walk around and there's the Walton stuff being going on there, and then we go around and they're shooting Dukes of Hazzard here. And
yeah, does it get any better than that?
Yeah, it was just... And it was all stuff that I didn't watch.
It didn't matter, though.
But it didn't matter. It was really a working studio. And we saw a Foley stage where they were doing, what's that movie, Time After Time, the H.G. Wells,
Malcolm McDowell.
Yeah, they were doing Foley for that. And we got to see a little session of that. So it was, the Warner Brothers lot has always struck me as being the best there was. I worked on the Paramount lot just a couple of years ago on this awful TV show, and we were in the Desilu Writing Building. I was actually writing in the Desilu Writers Building, and right next door there was a stage, because it was the RKO side of the Paramount lot, and right next door was a stage where Scenes from Citizen Kane had been shot, and Top Hat, and
all this stuff.
And nobody I worked with had any interest in that at all.
Why are they here? I've never understood that. No. Like, why do you come to Hollywood if you don't think the fact that you're working where Orson Welles and Lucille Ball worked is kind of cool?
Yeah. When you'd be, I mean, I don't remember when they took over the Writers Building there, so I don't think they wrote I Love Lucy in that building, but they wrote all the subsequent Desilu stuff, and I thought, probably Untouchables episodes were being written in this very room where we were writing this crap TV show now.
Yeah, once again, that's what I think is so interesting about movie studios, is this weird collision of all these different elements and crazy personalities and TV shows and movies set in vastly different spots of the world, shooting almost back-to-back to each other.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like you go to a real location and you can't find that weird synergy going on of all these different ghosts of stuff being shot today and stuff being shot 50 years ago kind of colliding and intermingling. There's a little, like an alcove, a courtyard at the Warner Brothers lot. And I found out that for the Batman TV series in the 60s, they shot some sequences there. And decades later, Tim Burton shot some sequences in the same area for Batman Returns.
Wow.
And a few years after that, Joel Schumacher shot one of his Batman pictures with that same little alcove in the background. And the second Christopher Nolan Batman film shot some sequences in the exact same spot. So you've got, what is it, four or five different incarnations of the same character shooting in the exact same spot or close to the exact same spot over several decades. You've got the whole history of Batman basically in that one little corner, and no one else has noticed it. No one else has made a point of how interesting and bizarre and wonderful this really is. I bet even the biggest fans of that character probably wouldn't recognize this set and know that their hero fought crime in Gotham City time after time after time in the same little tiny spot in the same studio.
Wow. Yeah, that stuff is fascinating to me, and I'm glad that Warner Brothers, and it might be the only studio that I know of that does it, now puts plaques on the stages that they tell at least some of the things that have been shot on those stages. Now, I always suspect some of those things, but I figure I'll...
They're probably more or less true.
Yeah, they're probably more or less
true. For Hollywood, that's pretty good.
Yeah, and But it's good. I mean, at least on Warner Brothers, you can walk up to a soundstage and there's a plaque that says, you know, Casablanca, To Have and Have Not, and, you know, what have now Voyager and all this stuff that scenes were shot
in. Yeah, it's shot in the same place.
Yeah.
One thing about those plaques, though, it's kind of, I won't say it's annoying because it's a good effort, and I know some people that worked on that very hard to get those titles up there, but people will look at it and they'll see the plaque with 20 titles on there and they'll say, well, this stage has been here since 1936 and only 20 films have shot in here. And, you know, like, it's, it's impossible to educate people. Like, yeah. If they don't know and they don't care, they're just not going to understand. They're not going to understand why those 20 films are important or interesting anyway.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, it's, you mentioned the Western town that was back there, and there used to be three Western towns at Warner Brothers alone.
Mm-hmm.
It was two complete Western streets and a Mexican village, and they had another Western street that was a lot longer up at their ranch in Calabasas. So most of the Westerns we all grew up watching took place on these sets, on these streets. Yeah. And when I used to go out to the last Western street that was on the lot, Laramie Street it was called, and I'd walk the plank sidewalks, and as you walk the sidewalks, you could hear the boards kind of creaking under your feet, and you could think to yourself, wow, that's the same sound that made when John Wayne or Randolph Scott walked in their big boots on these same sidewalks.
Yeah.
And there's just something kind of romantic and evocative about the whole thing.
Yeah, that stuff is kind of magical to me, and you're right. There are people who get it and people who don't. I always call it people who understand the cosmic joke. There are people who get things, and there are people who don't get things. And you know, we can be friends with the people who don't get it, but we can never love them. You know, we can only go with the people who understand these weird. It is an almost magical experience to be on this set and realize I am standing literally where Humphrey Bogart was standing in that scene in Casablanca. I'm standing in the same spot, you know, and he's long gone and the set is long gone, but this is still the place.
Those walls are still there.
Yeah, this is still the spot. Yeah. And there's something really something about that. And
you talked about stage 16. There's a Stage 16 is so tall, it's the only soundstage in the world that I'm aware of that has a restroom up in the rafters. And if you climb up, there's a long, long staircase going all the way up into the very top of the stage. And you can poke around in there, use the restroom if you're so inclined. But there's old graffiti, obscene graffiti from the 1930s etched in the rafters up there. And you can think of these board technicians that were sitting perched up there for hours on end, focusing arc lights on Humphrey Bogart down on the floor 80 feet below, you know.
Well, like, where else will you get that? Now I've got to go up there. I've only seen it from below. Now, somebody told me, I think probably Leith Adams told me the story about how they raised the roof of Stage 16. Do you know that story?
Yeah, it's one of these stories where you'd swear, you'd hear it and you'd say a publicist had to make this up because it's so ridiculous and absurd.
But it's true.
Apparently it's true. Apparently the stage was built in 1934, and just a few months later, in 1935, Cosmopolitan Pictures, which was William Randolph Hearst's production company, was shooting a picture there with Marion Davies and Clark Gable, who was on loan from MGM. And if you watch the movie, there really isn't. It's got some big production numbers, but there's nothing so impressive where you would think, gee, they would have needed a special soundstage for this. But there is a sequence with kind of a musical number with kind of a long staircase in it. And apparently, when they put the camera down on the floor, they couldn't quite shoot far enough, look far enough up into the stage because it was too short. So what they apparently decided to do, now I'm not an architect and I'm not an engineer, but I would think that if you had a building that was 67 feet high, which it was at the time, and you needed additional height on the building, you just knock the roof off and build up from the top of the building before the roof began.
Yeah, you'd think.
They didn't do this, though. Instead, what they did is they hired hundreds of out-of-work actors, dug down under the base of the stage into the asphalt, put hand jacks underneath, staggered 6 or 7 feet apart, underneath the stage, and then they had apparently like the galley scene in Ben-Hur or something on a cue, they had these out-of-work actors start to crank the stage up, so they laboriously raised the entire building, all 67 feet of it, another 30 feet using these jacks and building up as they went. That's Hollywood's version of the building of the pyramids, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, sure.
And there are pictures of this happening. I used to have pictures on my desk of dozens of people underneath the stage and signs saying, "Watch it rise." And apparently, now this part of the story I've never been able to substantiate, but I've heard it so many times that I choose to believe that it's true. Apparently, when they had raised the stage up and built the modern part of the stage underneath the original sound stage, when they had gotten an additional 30 feet that they needed to shoot this ridiculous musical number, the engineers told them that they were worried about how to lower the original stage onto the annex without the entire thing crumbling like a ridiculous house of cards.
Mm-hmm.
And so they scratched their head and thought about it, and I think they went to the mathematics department at USC or something like that. And finally someone suggested that the way to meld the old piece with the new piece was to put blocks of ice along the rim of the sound stage and lower the top part of the stage, the new 30 feet, onto the original part. And as the ice melted, it would slowly lower one piece into the other. And apparently this is what they did. And when the ice melted, they had the tallest soundstage in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, I've always heard that too. And the ice thing sounds so absurd and yet so ingenious that I've always believed it. And the fact that the rest of what they did was so weird. I mean, to use hand jacks to jack up this thing 30 feet is just amazing. It's really amazing. And it was all done for Citizen Kane.
All for Citizen Kane, that's right. That was Xanadu.
Well, when did your attentions turn to MGM? Because you did this great book, MGM...
Hollywood's greatest
Backlot. Yes. What made you decide to do that? Because that must have been a massive undertaking just to get the pictures, much less the research that it took to figure it out.
Well, like I told you, when I came to California, I started haunting the outsides of the movie studios. And out of the seven big lots in California that I always imagined dreaming or, you know, visiting and working at, six of them were more or less intact. You could go there, you could see the studio, you could walk around the fence. If you were brave enough, you could climb that fence. And even though a lot of the studios, like you said, have been downsized and parking lots have been built over back lots, they still had a physical presence in California. But MGM, to me, because by the time I got here, it was basically already all gone, it kind of had a Camelot feeling to it, because it was something that you could dream about, but you could no longer actually go to. It was like a lost kingdom out of a fairy tale. Because when I drove out to Culver City at that time, the studio, when I first got here, that MGM Studios had been bought by Lorimar Telepictures. And so what was left of their studio, the 40-acre front lot section of the studio, was all that was left, and it didn't even have MGM's name on it anymore. So it seemed like a great, almost Shakespearean tale about how the biggest and grandest and mightiest studio in Hollywood had been brought low by technology and by a lack of imagination by the people that were running it at the time. And it just struck me as such a wonderful romantic story. And I kind of decided I wanted to recreate the studio in the form of a book, because it wasn't something you could actually go and physically visit anymore. It was kind of my way of rebuilding the studio the only way that I possibly could. I should acknowledge my two co-authors, Stephen Sylvester and Michael Troyan. They kind of had the same crazy dream. And Steve had some wonderful photos that literally a friend of his had salvaged from a dumpster. Apparently at the time that in the 1960s when Man from U.N.C.L.E. was filming at MGM, the studio was aggressively trying to rent out their back lot. And so all the TV shows that were shooting on the lot, including U.N.C.L.E., had big three-ring binders. And in these binders, you could thumb through and look at pictures of all the different facades on all their different backlots. And so the art department and the screenwriters could use these photos without actually having to trudge out to these backlots and decide to figure out what sets were available, so that when Robert Vaughn needed to parachute into into Brazil or something for an episode, they could actually find out if they had something that could play Brazil that was available to them. So this was kind of a jumping off point. And I think we originally thought we'd kind of do a picture book, but it was just such a wonderful story, and it was such a tragic story that I couldn't bear the idea of not telling it, because nothing like this had ever been done. We had several agents, and we went to dozens of publishers. None of them could quite get it. Like, they kept saying, there's been books published about movie studios before. And I kept saying what I said to you. There's never been a book about a movie studio. There's been a book about the studio's movies, which is an entirely different thing. Like, I kind of wanted to take that aerial photo that was in every book about every movie studio, that single photo of the lot, and kind of zoom in and go down those streets. And we kind of decided we wanted to make it like a physical tour of the place. Like, what would happen if you walked in the front gate on a certain day and made a left turn and made a right turn, and what buildings you'd pass and what departments you'd pass and what sets you'd see and what you'd do. We kind of wanted to recreate. I guess what we ended up wanting to do was give people a guidebook to a place you couldn't visit anymore. You know, you can imagine how hard it is to sell a guidebook to a place that you can't actually use the guidebook to go and visit anymore. So that's kind of what we ended up doing, actually. And we finally found a publisher that could kind of see what we were trying to do. 10 years later, this finally happened. So,
well, it's an amazing book. I can get lost in it for hours, because it really, like you said, it's fascinating to look at, let's pick a random thing, the Waterloo Bridge, and just think, here's what it was made for, and then here it is in a movie about a castle, and here it is in a movie about something else. And here's Eva Marie Saint in front of it, and here's Joan Fontaine and doing a scene in front of it. It's just the same bridge, this same tiny body of water that they made to look like a big lake or a river sometime. And it's just this one thing, and it always looks the same, yet.
Yeah, did you ever recognize it all the hundreds of times you probably
really
saw it?
No, but you never register it unless for some reason, you know, you're like us and you're wired to look for that stuff. But even so, I get surprised by how many, you know, like the St. Louis Street, which shows up in who knows how many movies. It's even in How the West Was Won. It's in all kinds of movies, and they just had these great Victorian era houses, and so it's really fascinating to look at that.
Yeah, something like that street almost becomes like our idolized version of our own hometown.
Yeah.
We all kind of grew up in that street. If we grew up in the right period of time, and even today to a certain degree, we all grew up in these places. Like, we've all been there hundreds of times, even if we've never physically been there. I mean, something like a fifth of the movies made in the United States historically for 50 years were made at MGM.
Wow.
So we've all been on that St. Louis Street probably more times than we could ever imagine. And it's kind of the place we all wish we'd grown up, but probably never did in most cases. I've talked to a lot of people who grew up in St. Louis, and they were like, I kept looking for that street, and I could never figure out exactly where it was. So, you know, we've all haunted that place, and it's, you know, thumbing through the book, there's going to be things in there that are going to be familiar to us. So, in a way, it's a guidebook of a place we have been to many, many, many times over the entire course of our lives. You know, it's kind of haunting and kind of creepy and kind of romantic in a way. There's a Twilight Zone episode where we got a quote from someone where Rod Serling was talking about how he was walking around the back lot at MGM, and he got to thinking, you know, it's really strange that this looks so recognizable. What would happen if you leaned on a tree and it fell over and it turned out it was actually made of plaster of Paris? And that's something that could only happen in the movie studio backlot. But he thought, this is like the ultimate Twilight Zone episode. And it kind of is, in a way. And they, you know, ironically enough, they ended up filming that on those actual sets. So
I've been with people on backlot, and they're somehow disappointed.
They're disappointed
by the false
it's fake,
front.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the part that I love. You can see a real house anywhere.
Yeah.
We're in one right now.
Anybody could go and take a picture of the Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
And it's going to be beautiful. And,
exactly.
But, you know, to make a believable Grand Canyon inside a movie studio, that's much more interesting than actually going to the real place, as far as I'm concerned.
But I find it so, I mean, I was thinking about this because of the St. Louis Street, that those Victorian mansions are so huge and so incredible and detailed and all that. And yet, if you look at them from the side, they're tiny. I mean, they're huge fronts, and they're not flat. So it's not like it's just a flat front. There is dimension to them, but it would be about the size of one room
in a real house
from front to back if it were a real house.
Yeah, I think there's a picture in the book where you can see one of the mansions from the side, and it's just way too narrow. You're right, it's a real building with fronts and backs, but the perspective is just all off.
Yeah,
like they keep doing that, and that's what's another thing that's interesting about movie backlots is that, you know, they do play with perspective and size and dimension, and second floors are smaller than first floors, and doors are small for larger actors, so they look larger when they walk through. I mean, that's so much more interesting than going out to a real house somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned the Waterloo Bridge set, and if you could stand back far enough from the lake that this bridge was built over, you'd realize it was ridiculous and absurd to even have a bridge at all, because the bank of the bridge was just 20 feet away from the bridge. You could have just walked around the lake with another 10 seconds of your time. But
sure.
But you never noticed that because it was all designed to be seen by a camera as opposed to being seen by a real eyeball.
So you never got there in time to see any of the backlot.
No, and that's part of the reason that it's kind of a romantic obsession for me, because I missed it all. One of my my partners, Stephen Sylvester, went there and took a tour when he was a kid. And briefly in the 1960s, apparently MGM was trying, they were hemorrhaging money at this point, and they thought they could make a few bucks by offering a public tour. And he said it was completely chaotic and unorganized. They basically just said, go and play for 40 minutes, we'll pick you up. But he wandered around for a little while and thought it was the most amazing place he'd ever seen. He said his parents took him to Disneyland the next day, and he was so disappointed. He thought Disneyland was so cramped and so small and miniaturized and insubstantial compared to the MGM backlot. And I still tease him about this. I were like, why didn't you take some pictures? So we've got hundreds of pictures in the book, but none of them are from that day when he was at MGM, which it kind of changed his life. And I wasn't even there, and it apparently changed my life as well. So
I've been told, this is a complete tangent, but you mentioned Disneyland. I've been told that everything there was built at 7/10 to scale because he wanted it to seem not like a real place, but like you're wandering among kind of a toy place. And I was friends with Charlie Barton, who directed Abbott and Costello movies, but also a lot of Disney stuff, the Shaggy Dog and Toby Tyler and Zorro episodes and Spin and Marty episodes and all that. And one day I was talking with Charlie and I said, is it true that Disneyland was built at 7/10 to scale, was reduced to 7/10 to scale? And Charlie said, Walt Disney reduced everyone he ever worked with to 7/10 to scale.
I guess there was your answer, or maybe not. Well, I know that, like, Disneyland, for obvious reasons, was designed by studio craftsmen. Like, you know, Walt obviously used his own people and people from other studios that he'd work with when he designed his park. So it would make sense they used a lot of the same tricks that they'd learned in movie making. And if anyone else would have, you know, if Disneyland would have came from somewhere outside the entertainment industry, if it would have been designed by a beer manufacturer or something, it would have been an entirely different experience than it is now.
One of the things that I first noticed, and maybe somebody pointed it out, maybe I'm not so insightful as I think I am, maybe somebody mentioned it to me. When the first time I was on the Warner Brothers lot, I noticed that there are no corners to any of the streets. All the streets curve. And I asked somebody about that later, and they said, it's because it always gives you the sense that there's something else around that curve, even though there's not. And in many cases, they aren't. But if it was just, you know, if it just did a dead end and had a corner, it wouldn't give you that same sense of...
It would probably be harder to shoot,
space,
too.
Space, yeah. And yeah. So it's like, and once I noticed that, every time I would go through a studio lot, I noticed that that's the case, that there's no, like, T-sections of streets. There's no cross streets like that, unless it was built for something very specific. Were you over there on the lot quite a bit when you were employed by Warner Brothers?
Every chance I could get. I kept thinking I would eventually get tired of the place and the magic would wear off, because a lot of the people there really, they either were not interested to begin with, or if you notice, a lot of the people that actually work on sets today, those jobs are so difficult to get, they end up inheriting them. So sometimes the guys that are on the sets are two or three generations of a certain family, a miniature Hollywood dynasty that's been doing the same thing for decades. So they don't think it's strange that they're rigging cars to explode, or they're making a cigarette ash that will fall off a cigarette tip on cue, or that they're building a futuristic spaceship that's going to explode. They think that that's all in a day's work. So they don't think it's particularly romantic because it's the only life they've ever known. But because I didn't have that background, I used to wander through these places. I'd walk through the sound stages every chance I'd get. I'd crawl underneath the sound stages. I'd go up in the rafters. I explored dripping basements and catacombs. I wandered around in the prop department staring at pieces for days on end trying to figure out where they came from. I annoyed the workers in the costume department trying to trace down costumes and figure out who wore what when. So it was always kind of a challenge, and it was always an experience, and it was fun spending weekends in a movie studio and kind of living out those dreams that I had when I was a kid watching movies at 3 p.m. It's kind of something I think once it gets in your blood, it's really hard to exercise that demon, although I've certainly tried.
Well, don't try too hard. It's fun. Now, when you were working on the MGM studio book, did MGM give you any cooperation?
Actually, MGM basically said, you're welcome to do what you like. There's not much we can do to help you because a lot of the movies and a lot of the materials involving our physical studio we don't have anymore and we don't have the rights to anymore. The only restriction that they ever gave me, they said, you know, don't put our logo on the cover because that will imply that we're actually publishing the book or we're actually behind it somehow. So they were extremely helpful in not getting in my way, I guess is the best thing I could say about the current MGM management. They were wonderful. And I actually, if you look very carefully at my book, the studio logo is in miniature. There's an aerial view, and you can see Leo the Lion on the roof of a soundstage in the far background of the shot. So any of my friends who are at the current MGM who are watching this, I apologize for lying to you about putting your logo on the cover. But I've talked to a lot of people over there and at the current Sony lot who say they love the book because it kind of gives people an idea of what happened there and what happened at MGM and what happened at their studio back in the day. And as I understand it, I think Sony is still selling the book in their studio store, right, which I think is terrific, although I can't imagine the conversations that come up from people walking into the studio store and seeing a book about a rival studio on a coffee table there. So I'd love to hear some of those conversations, actually. But
so wait a minute. You wrote a book and people buy it? How does that work?
It actually did surprisingly well, which I'm so thrilled at. I mean, a book like this, you know, it's all relative. I don't know how many people, I don't know what the actual raw sales figures are, but we're in our fourth printing, which is astonishing.
Wow.
I mean, they only printed 9 copies the first time they fired up the presses, and I don't know what the total sales are, but for a book like this, it's did really well because it is, I think, kind of different. It's not about the movies, like I said. It's about the factory, and I think people have kind of responded to that, so. I'll probably never have another book quite as successful again.
See, not only do my books not get 4 printings, but the publishers try to expunge the record so that they can claim that there were never any printings at all.
Now, Frank, I don't think you're giving yourself the credit for the sometimes double and even triple digit sales that I'm sure your books have racked up. So,
yes, I know. I can greet personally by name everyone who's ever bought one of my books. How did you get Debbie Reynolds to write the foreword?
That was kind of a dream that we could get Debbie. We kept trying to think about somebody who actually was a name, a marquee name, that was actually interested in the studio. And for a long time, we kind of had our sights set on Elizabeth Taylor because she was probably the one actress that's probably most identified with MGM. But we never could quite get through her people to her, for one thing. That's the honest truth about it. But as we thought about it later, it's probably just as well we didn't get Elizabeth Taylor, just because I really think for someone like her, who is a movie star practically from the day she tumbled out of the womb, she probably wouldn't have thought that MGM was anything extraordinary because it was the only life she ever knew. And I don't really think that she spent a lot of time poking around the studio and exploring it. I suspect that a limo probably drove her out to her soundstage. She got out, she said her lines, she was escorted back into her dressing room, and at 6 o'clock that evening she would go home to her house in Beverly Hills. Even though she was at MGM for years, I don't think she would have thought it was particularly extraordinary, and I don't think that she probably could have found her way from one end of the studio to the other if you'd have dropped her in the middle of it. Debbie Reynolds, on the other hand, came to the studio when she was 19 after a very normal childhood. So I think from the very beginning, she kind of realized what a strange and bizarre and wonderful place this was. And she kind of appreciated it. And she spent a lot of time exploring the studio and looking around. And she said that when she was making movies at the studio, she would bring her kids in and she'd kind of set them loose and say, go out and play. And they would spend the day crawling around the back lots while she was working on them. Todd Fisher, one of her sons, gave a wonderful interview to us. And he said that, he said that most kids they'd watch a movie where they'd see a pirate ship, and the next day in their backyard they would play and pretend that they were on that pirate ship. But he said, I had a skewered childhood because my sister Carrie and I would be driven out to the studio the next day with our mother, and we could actually go out in the back lot and play on the actual pirate ship that movie was made on. So he said, you know, I realized just how odd and how different my childhood was from every other child. So we kind of set our sights on Debbie, and her people kept saying, no, she's too busy, she doesn't have the time. And we just kept trying, where eventually in the classic Hollywood fashion, it became easier for her to say yes than to continue to say no. So she contributed a wonderful introduction to the book, and we're thrilled to have had her on board for something like this, because I think she's probably the perfect person to, you know, to share a few thoughts and a few feelings about actually working at the studio.
Yeah, in the in my day job, where we're archiving stills for Warner Brothers and other studios, I don't believe there's any human on earth who has photographed more than Debbie Reynolds. Thousands of pictures. You would not believe how many pictures there are of Debbie Reynolds.
Well, apparently, I think she's a good sport, too. Like, yeah. Probably Elizabeth Taylor, being, you know, a little bit more of a diva, I suspect, would have said, no, you've taken your picture of me today. I'm going to have a drink. And I think Debbie kind of played along, and I think she realized how much fun it was, and I think she did have fun. So she kind of did what her studio wanted, because, she was signed up there from the time she was a teenager. So I think her parents had probably told her, you should obey your elders. So that's kind of what she did, and kind of what she's still doing to a certain degree. And of course, she started collecting pieces from the studio as it was dismantled, and she bought pieces at the MGM auction and has been collecting pieces for years. So she's not only one of Hollywood's premier surviving movie stars, but she's one of Hollywood's premier surviving historians too, in some ways. So
yeah.
it all dovetailed perfectly into getting her to work on our book.
It's really horrible reading in your book about the last stages when they were just tearing down all the backlot, because there was a lot of great stuff. It really does seem like they could have found something to do with. I remember, I know Robert Noodleman, the late Robert Noodleman, who was a real preservationist, and he worked very hard to try to get them to save a lot of this stuff, but he found that there were genuine antiques that they had brought for props. They were just being bulldozed and buried and burned and trashed and just all this stuff that you just think, what a treasure trove of materials were just dumped.
Yeah, if it hadn't been such a fire sale sort of thing where they wanted to get as much cash as they could as quickly as they could have, if they would have been more orderly about disposing of their assets, they could have made a lot more money.
Sure.
I mean, even the MGM auction, they found an auctioneer who would give them a couple million dollars basically just to take the pieces off their hands, and they said, you can have whatever you want.
Wow.
I mean, they didn't restrict. They just said, go through and take what you like and auction it off. They didn't even take a percentage. They took a flat rate for this. And you're right, a lot of the pieces were incredibly historic as film history, but they were also actual antiques. The studio used to send buyers to Europe, and they bought pieces from the Tsar's palace in Russia and from the royal palaces in France and Belgium and England, and they took them back and they used them in movies for decades. And so these pieces were historic both for what they were used for and what their background was before that, and they were just thrown away or given away. A lot of the pieces that were sold at the auction weren't sold as pieces of film history, because there really was no such thing as film history being intrinsically valuable then. A big deal was made at the time because the ruby slippers from The Wizard of Oz went for $15,000, and it was all over the press because no one could believe that anyone would pay $15,000 for a pair of shoes with pasted on sequins. They weren't even real rubies. But that was probably the first piece that anyone ever decided was intrinsically valuable on its own, rather than it was valuable because of what it was used for and what it represented, rather than what it was actually made of. But most of the pieces were sold just because of the scrap that you could get out of them, or because you could actually use them. One of the prosecutors on the Manson trial, which was happening at the time, went to the auction and bought suits that he wore in the trial. And oddly enough, apparently his taste in clothing wasn't very good because he was eventually bumped off, allegedly, by the Manson family, who didn't like what he was doing for him. So I don't know if I don't think they ever found his body, but I've always wondered if he was wearing one of the suits he bought at MGM when he met his mysterious demise.
Yeah, where did those suits show up? Were they William Powell's
suits?
Yeah,
who had worn those clothes before?
Yeah, so weird. Is the movie The Phantom of Hollywood available on DVD?
Actually, it just came out last year through the Warner Archive Collection. Ah, okay. And if you haven't seen that, I strongly encourage you to watch it. In some ways, it was kind of, I almost felt like it was autobiographical or in a wish fulfillment sort of way that I wished it would have been autobiographical. I didn't relate to the humans or the normal people in the movie. Personally, when I saw it, I related to the Phantom because the movie, if you haven't seen it, is about a deranged actor who, when he finds out that the backlot of his movie studio, where he's been living in the catacombs for decades, is about to be torn down, he goes out on a rampage of revenge to try to bump off the studio executives that are responsible for this sacrilege. And it's such a weird film, if you think about it, because it was actually made by the studio executives that were tearing down their own backlot at the time. And I don't know if they didn't realize that that the script was basically pointing an accusing finger at them, or if they didn't care, or if they fully understood the irony of what they were doing, but went ahead anyway just because it was a way to make them some money. But it's a really strange, almost self-despising movie that MGM would make about itself, criticizing what it was doing at the very moment that it was doing it.
Yeah.
And there's some great footage of the facades being toppled over, of medieval castles being bulldozed and things like that that was actually going on at the time this movie was being made. But it's a very radical movie in its modest made for television sort of way. It's astonishing what the movie was saying about what was actually going on in Hollywood at the time that this was happening. I've always thought it strange too that the head of the studio in this film is played by Peter Lawford. And all his, you know, this was during his ascot-wearing oily charm period.
Sure.
But his daughter, who is menaced by the Phantom, is played by an actress named Sky Aubrey. And in real life, her father was James Aubrey, who was the actual head of the studio at the time. So you've kind of got this weird funhouse mirror sort of reflections going on and ricocheting across each other over the course of this film. And you have to wonder who made this film and what in the world they were thinking. And you know, at the end of the day, it didn't matter. The backlot was destroyed anyway. No Phantom came to the rescue. But it's a very odd film, and it's available through Warner Home Video. And if you haven't seen it, you should probably check it out. There was one critic, I don't remember what his name was, but he said that the film was a treat for masochistic film lovers.
Yeah, it is a really odd film, and I remember it very well, seeing it when it was new and realizing what it was showing, and then, you know, the more time passes, the more of a weird documentary it becomes of what was really happening there. Just a terrible time in Hollywood history. And those people who were running MGM were everything that you always make fun of movie executives being. They were just soulless animals. They really had no idea what they had, and they didn't even dispose of it with any intelligence or, not to mention, any taste. They just, because clearly they had none, but they could have done so much with that. And they could have, as you said, could have made so much more money if they had just gone about it with a half a brain. And they did not.
It was all about, you know, making money immediately to reflect in their year-end bonus.
Yeah.
And they didn't care what happened afterwards. And immediately the studio basically resented. I mean, almost immediately they decided that what they did after they sold off, especially Lot 2, which was a major backlot sector across the street from their main studio, probably the most filmed area in the world, when they sold that off almost immediately, they realized that they had nowhere to shoot the projects that they'd already been contracted to shoot. So they had to immediately go and lease back the property, and they continued to use this property for the next 10 years as a tenant, because they had hurriedly sold it off. And the whole time they were selling it off, it was supposed to be purchased by the Levitt Housing Company to build cookie-cutter suburbs. And that deal eventually fell through, and it eventually was purchased by a Chinese scrap dealer who had the idea that by digging underneath these sets, you could retrieve the copper wiring that they were wired with. So he would be digging up sets and tearing up the grounds on one side of the studio to save this copper wire so he could sell it off as scrap, while 60 feet away, MGM would be shooting one of their own movies on the property, which they had leased for the day. So it must have been a strange and humiliating thing that they had to lease back their own property for almost a decade after they sold it off.
Right. Well, they deserve all the humiliation they can.
Yeah, it's hard to feel too sorry for them.
Absolutely.
At that point. But you know, the people that were doing this though never left their carpeted offices in the Thalberg building. It was the production people that actually had to go out and get the product done that had to deal with all this craziness going on.
I wonder how much more footage there is, like the footage that shows up in Phantom of Hollywood, because there's not a great deal in that movie of the sets being demolished, but you get the idea that they must have been filming a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, I'm sure there's other footage out there. 60 Minutes did a piece when the backlot was being destroyed, and I think some footage was taken for that too. And I contacted CBS to see if there was anything they could do to find some more footage, and they couldn't even get me a copy of the segment. They did sell me a transcript, which was all I was able to get my hands on. But I know they probably took some footage of the destruction, which was happening at the time Mike Wallace was out there. And there was an interview with King Vidor that was done, I think, for the DGA, where they shot him on Quality Street, which he had apparently used. I don't think he used it for the big parade, but he shot some sequences for the big parade out there. So there's footage both owned by the studio and outside companies showing the destruction of the studio and showing the last days of the studio about the time it was being destroyed. And like I said, they kept making movies out there to the very end. One of the last things shot on New York Street was an episode of Chips, I think. And there was a TV show in the late 70s called Buck Rogers in the 25th Century. And they had a sequence involving a ruined Chicago that Universal sent a crew out there to shoot. St. Louis Street was used in an episode of, believe it or not, Rod Serling's Night Gallery. They used one of the houses as a haunted house. And this was shot, apparently, as far as I can tell, almost the same day that that house was destroyed.
Wow.
So this stuff was actually being used up until the very end. The Dino De Laurentiis King Kong remake from 76 shot almost all their exteriors on the MGM backlot. Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band went to Andy Hardy Street and rebuilt it for some long sequences involving the Bee Gees and the nonsense that went on in the course of that movie. So you can see these sets being used almost up until the very point that the Caterpillars tore them down. So they were still a viable entity, and they were still making money for someone, if not for MGM, right up until the very end. The last photos, as far as I can tell, that anyone ever took of the MGM backlot were actually taken by MGM. MGM at the time, which was across the street, was building a parking structure, which is what movie studio executives really like to do, is build parking structures. And they hired a photographer to document the rising of this big, beautiful, monolithic parking structure. And so he took pictures of this parking structure every day. I saw his proof sheets. And you could tell he was bored to death photographing this boring block of cement. So every once in a while, he'd turn his camera and shoot across the street. And at the end of a roll, occasionally, you'd find five or six pictures of the Caterpillars tearing down New York Street across the street from the job that he was actually being paid to photograph. So he was kind of getting New Hollywood on one side of the street and Old Hollywood on the other. And as far as I know, those are the last pictures anyone took, and it was pretty deplorable looking at that point.
Wow. That's just such a terrible story. Just such a terrible moment in Hollywood history. But it's something that was echoed across Hollywood. I mean, most of the backlots of most of the studios are gone now. You look at the Fox backlot. Century City used to be mostly Fox backlot. So
yeah.
All of that stuff is gone. It's only what's within the gates of the studio that are left. So it's not like MGM was alone in doing this, but it's really a shame. And I guess you can understand it from a financial point of view that maybe it doesn't pay to maintain these big standing sets especially Western sets when you're not making any Westerns or that sort of thing. But still, you know, stuff is in production all the time. There's TV shows and movies being made every single day of our lives, and lots of them. So you'd think that all these things would still have a life.
Yeah, even if it's not an immediate life. You know, the Laramie Street over at Warner Brothers, they were still using it. They were using it often, but they were using it right up until the very end. I mean, it wasn't like it was being used as a traditional movie studio set because a lot of Westerns weren't being made. But there were still shoots going on out there. On Annie Leibovitz shot some still shoots out there. They had corporate parties out there. A TV Western shot out there for an entire season just a couple of years before the set was torn down, The Adventures of Briscoe County. So, I mean, there were, you know, it wasn't like they were making big money off backlot sets and backlot rentals, but they could have justified it if they wanted to. The trouble is that, especially today, real estate in a movie studio is so valuable, and there's so many people that work for the studio that want to work at the studio and be able to brag to their friends that they're working on the lot at Warner's, that they end up eventually always having more sway than the people who want to preserve the backlots, which are the production people, which aren't really on the inside. They're not involved in deciding what stays and what goes. So it's the people that aren't actually using them that get to make the call about whether or not these sets are going to continue to stand, which is, you know, it's a shame that that's the way that it is. I was out with a production guy, he was like a locations manager, and he was walking around the studio jungle. There's a few couple acres of palm trees and little lakes and foliage out in the studio that they use for every exterior sequence. And he was shooting it was like a Steven Seagal picture set in Alaska or something. And he was taking notes, and at one point he kind of threw his notebook down, and he said, you know, it makes me so mad. They get mad when I have to leave the studio, but yet they keep tearing down the very spots that that would allow me to stay and continue to work here. They just torn off a corner of the jungle to put up a parking lot for Warner Records, I remember. And he was like, you know, I can't really win. They want me to shoot here, but yet they won't give me any place to shoot.
On Warner Brothers, what's left now? You got the New York Street and then the other city street that was built for Annie, I think, right?
It was there before Annie, but it was rebuilt extensively for that film. So, yeah, there's kind of a tenement district off to the side over there, and you know you can see some of those facades going back to, I think, Angels with Dirty Faces back in '38 used some of those sets, and you know once again that's a big piece of our pop culture as Americans was built on what took place on those sets, but yet there's no one out there to protect them.
Well, it's walking around just what's left of the Warner's lot, the city streets and so forth, and the King's Row street and all that. It really is a history of the movies right there. I mean, you can see the doorway where James Cagney stood.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I mean, just that kind of stuff, and you know, the theaters and how many times that theater on the lot has shown up in movies.
Think of all any time that you needed a movie theater or a vaudeville house or a burlesque house or a Broadway show palace, it'd be that silly old rickety theater facade that's on New York Street that you're talking about. I mean, that you can see it in 42nd Street when at the end of the movie when Warner Baxter walks out of the theater, walks around the front of the theater and sits on kind of a staircase going up into the side of the theater, and he listens to people walking out of the theater and talking about how good his show was and how easy it must have been to put together. I mean, you can still walk out there and see that same theater. More or less, there was a backlot fire that took out a lot of that facade, but it still basically looks like it did back in what was 42nd Street, 31,
33?
32. Yeah.
And you know, the stairs are still there.
The stairs are still there, the same ones that he sat on.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can still see that theater going all the way up into the, what was the movie that won Best Picture last year? The silent film.
The Artist.
The Artist, thank you. Yeah. The Artist used that exact same theater facade. So you've got, like you said, the entire history of talking pictures from 33 all the way up into last year using that same set.
I was working when I wrote a lot for American Movie Classics back when they showed movies. I wrote intros for guest hosts. And one time we were doing a series of Shirley Temple films and got Kirsten Dunst to introduce them. And that's where we shot that theater.
Now, how perfect.
So yeah. There was a big, they put Shirley Temple on the marquee. And then Kirsten, who was, I think, 12 or something like that at the time, 12 or 13, would just stand out in front of the theater and do the intros. And, you know, I remember sitting, I made it a point at lunchtime to go over and sit on the, sit where Warner Baxter sat and had my lunch there, you know.
And see, that becomes another little piece of the puzzle about the vast tapestry that's the history of that set is the fact that you wrote intros for Kirsten Dunst out there. You became a part of it all.
Part of it, yes. More important than Warner Baxter. That's what I am, that's for sure.
Bite my lip on that comment.
Well, more living than Warner Baxter, you got to give me that.
Yes, your recent resume entries have been much more impressive than his. So.
Have you been tempted to do this with other studios, or is it too daunting a task?
No, you know, I'm hoping that I had to get a licensing agreement with Warner Brothers, who were terrific about giving me one to do the MGM book, because, as you know, they control a lot of the photography and a lot of the titles that I had to discuss. So I'm working on doing a similar sort of piece for Warner Brothers, which would be terrific. It's also in some ways more daunting because I'm dealing with more of an ongoing entity than I am with MGM. MGM basically just let me do what I wanted. And Warner Brothers obviously has a current and vested interest in the property. So I'm going to have to work with them a lot more closely than I did on my MGM book, which is fine, but it just involves a lot more politics. But I'd like to do that. And, there's seven big studios in town. There's one good idea that I had in my entire life. I could probably milk it for decades if I wanted to. So it really just depends about the studio and the ghosts that live there and whether or not those ghosts want to talk to me, I suppose.
That's a good point. Just take a medium with you and make sure that happens. The FGM, I was thinking about the Warner's lot because Warner's had the ranch out in Calabasas. So it had other places that were pretty much permanent setups besides just on the studio. MGM didn't really have that, did it? I mean, it was those three big...
Yeah, it was their main... all their lots were in Culver City.
Yeah.
They didn't really need a ranch just because their back lot was so complete and so all-encompassing that there was never really any need for them to purchase an outside property. In some ways, MGM was easier because it was all basically enclosed in one big fenced-in compound. And the other studios involved, you know, other studio lots that they had in different places, sometimes in New York, sometimes in England, other studio lots in California. You know, MGM owned the Vitagraph lot in East Hollywood. Mm-hmm. Their original lot was down on Sunset. There was their ranch in Calabasas. There's their current ranch, which is the old Columbia Studios ranch, and I'm just trying to grapple with how much to cover these other properties. You know, you kind of spread yourself a little thin where you're not telling the story particularly well on any of the properties because you're trying to cover all of them.
Well, you got to cover the Calabasas set because it's the only way you can get the Alamo into this book. So,
the San Antonio Alamo, right? Yeah. You can tell you've got two Alamo junkies talking to each other here. So, yeah,
that's you know, talking about sets that were used over and over and over again, that's the weird thing, because I've never seen that Alamo set in any other film of the time. And that was a big set.
Yeah, you have to wonder why not.
Why didn't it show up as something else?
It could have been another mission or something like that, but yet it seemed to be there for however many weeks they were shooting, and then it wasn't there anymore.
I've never seen another movie.
Yeah, and it's an amazing looking set too. I mean, I don't know at what point. I mean, presumably the fight scenes inside were probably in a soundstage back in Burbank. But you know, they spend a lot of time walking in front of that facade, and it's one of the better Alamo facades.
Really great looking. Yeah,
it's a really impressive set actually. It always reminds me of the scene shot in Brackettville of from Lonesome Dove.
Yes. Where,
you know, for some reason, I always think of the movie San Antonio and Lonesome Dove the same way, and that they kind of have the Alamo 20 years after the Battle of the Alamo, and they're almost taking it for granted as they walk past it.
Yeah, but at least it's there. And at least once you get, if you start doing about Warner Brothers, at least you'll have a studio that made some Foreign Legion pictures. Unlike that bum MGM that never did any.
That was another reason MGM maybe never needed a ranch, because they weren't particularly known for like westerns and big outdoors pictures and that sort of thing. So, you know, maybe that's why they didn't need to have 1,000 acres up in Calabasas or something like that. But, you know, that said, they had three very complete western streets on their lot in Culver City, and they were among the probably the best western streets ever built anywhere in Hollywood. And compared to western streets at probably any other studio, they were relatively underused. And a lot of the pictures they did make that were westerns, that weren't westerns, that shot on these streets, they kind of did a lot to hide the fact that it was a western street. So a lot of the, you know, but they had a, they had Ghost Town Street, which was, I think, built for, was it Boomtown? Which is kind of a semi-western. Yeah. And Western Street, which was called Western Street, but was a little more urban than most western sets at the other studios. It kind of looked almost a turn of the century type street. And then they had, there was an annex called Monterey Street, which they used for westerns and involving cavalry forts and that sort of thing. And there was a Rawhide Street, which that was basically constructed for the Clint Eastwood picture. So I mean, they had a lot of western architecture that was relatively unused, at least until the television era. And at one point, the studio, for some reason in the 60s, decided that they were going to buy property up in, was it Sherman Oaks or something like that, and move their entire studio operation up there. And according to Roger Mayer, who was a vice president of facilities at the time, after they bought the property, they started encouraging employees to move up to Sherman Oaks. And, of course, it never happened. So they ended up moving to Sherman Oaks and then having to commute to Culver City.
That's a pain.
Yeah.
Somebody that I recently interviewed for this podcast has a place in Culver City, and he said, oh, you can come to my place in Culver City and interview me there. And I just went, oh, man.
Do I have to?
From here, it's a drive down there. So
I talked to someone in animation for a little while at Warner Brothers. Chuck Jones and some of his original animators came back to the studio to make some cartoons in the 90s. And the studio didn't really think it through. In the 90s, there wasn't a lot you could do with a 7-minute animated cartoon except syndicate it with the 7-minute animated cartoons that were 50 years old.
Sure.
So it didn't last very long, but for a while there was kind of a mini flowering of the golden age of animation, and they moved them back to the Termite Terrace building on the lot for a few years. And I talked to one of the animators there who lived in Culver City, and so he had to drive up to Burbank every day, and he said they wanted to put the animation people as far from the real guts of the studio as they could, because they thought that the animators were barely human. So they put them out on the back lot in the farthest, darkest reaches of the back lot. So he said to get to his car every day, he had to walk through one of the western towns. And he said that every once in a while he'd walk through and they'd be wrapping a western and like throwing stuff away. And he'd say, well, can I have that barrel, or do you need those swinging saloon doors or something? They'd say, no, just take it away. It'll save us from having to put it back. So he started loading the stuff up in his car, and he'd drive it down to Culver City. And he started building a miniature version of this western street in his backyard in Culver City.
Wow.
And he said eventually it included like 6 or 7 buildings and a street and a saloon and a hitching post. And I was like, you've got to be kidding. He said, let me show you. And he pulled out some pictures from his wallet, and he built kind of a miniature homemade version of this movie studio western street at his house. And he said, my daughters used to love playing it. They'd have tea parties in the saloon.
Well, now I want to do that.
Yeah, doesn't that sound like you should have something like that here?
Well, after I finish with my Fort Zinderniff in the backyard, I will. So, well, Steve, I think we've gone longer than any humans should go on something like this.
I'm sure your listeners will feel the same way.
No, they're going to be begging for more. More, they'll say. So I really appreciate this, that you're coming all the way out here to the wilds of Encino to talk with me. And also, congratulations on the recent birth of your new daughter. Now, I understand that you did not name her Frank, as I suggested, but
Frank was the second choice. So.
Well, at least it was in consideration. That's all I have.
Yes, it was not. It was not slashed off the list until my wife actually saw the list. So,
and She's what, a month old now?
She was a month old yesterday. She was born on the 26th. And
wow.
She's already completely manipulated us and turned our lives around. So.
I can imagine that. So she's talking and walking and...
She Googles and
Googles?
Makes funny noises, and occasionally she'll grab your finger with her little tiny hand, which just causes our hearts to melt immediately.
Sure.
So.
Well, how could it not?
Yeah, it's
well,
kind
congratulations.
Of,
that's the greatest news of all. So.
Yes, I can't wait to let her grow up a little bit and become obsessed with backlots.
You know, she will, because if there's anything that we know about life is that kids always become obsessed with what their parents love.
That those are the only cool things, the things that your parents
absolutely
are into.
Yeah. So that's always been true, and it always will be true. So thanks a lot. I really appreciate it, and let's do it again one of these days.
Well, thanks for asking me.
I hope, nay, I know that you enjoyed that interview with Steve Bingham, and I will have him back one of these days, particularly if he finally does this book on the Warner Brothers studio, which I think would be great. And so he will certainly come back to talk about that. And who knows, we might even have him back before then to talk about MGM some more, because there's lots more to go into. And he's a great guy to talk to. Good friend of mine, like him a lot, and he really knows his stuff. James Hutchins also knows his stuff. He's the guy who designed my websites, thecommentarytrack.com and frankthompson.tv. I urge you to go there, buy books that I've written, buy videos on which I've worked in some capacity, and always, when you do that, order through the Amazon link on those pages, and I'll get a kickback. I want you to also order Steve Bingham's book, MGM, Hollywood's Greatest Backlot, and order that through the Amazon link, and that way Steve gets a book sale, I get a little bit of a kickback, you get an incredible book, Amazon makes a sale, everybody is happy. When, how many times can you do that in life where everybody involved is just delighted? Everybody. There's no loser here. It's just great. And I do that for every one of my guests on the podcast. We'll list their books, their videos, whatever they have, and you go to the specific page for them on the Commentary Track website, and you'll see all the stuff that you can buy. They will appreciate it. I will appreciate it. Amazon will appreciate it. And I think, by inference, the whole universe will appreciate it. I also want to thank my wife, Claire McCullough, my wonderful announcer. I want to thank Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for writing my terrific theme music fore and aft, because that's beautiful stuff, and I'm proud and delighted to have it. I want to thank you, the listener, for going to iTunes and leaving a good review and a 5-star rating to help get other people to the podcast. I also want to thank you for going to the Commentary Track Facebook page and hitting the like button. Liking my page will also help spread it out to other people. And I just am trying to get more ears on this podcast. And we have some more great guests coming up. In fact, we have some truly terrific guests coming up. I have at least 3 guests booked right now that I'm thinking, how in the world would I even speak to people of this caliber, much less have them on my own show? And I think you're going to be tickled pink when they finally get here. So there's lots of good stuff coming up. And I want to thank you very much for supporting this podcast. I'm getting great responses. The people leave very nice things on iTunes, and I get very nice emails almost every day from listeners. Everybody seems to like the which way it's going, and that makes me feel great. So please, let's keep it going. Keep spreading the word. Start spreading the news. I'm not going to say New York, New York, although I could, because I have a lovely voice. But I'll let you go now, and we'll see you next week. And in the meantime, don't you worry, we'll fix it in post.